Well, before we continue with our study of systematic theology this morning, let me just bring everyone up to speed with what we discussed last Lord's Day. I'm not going to give an exhaustive review of that. If you missed any of last week's message, please go to Sermon Audio and give the first part of this series a lesson. As I said last week, this is going to be a series that will take us probably the better part of the next few years. And I say few years, kind of reservedly, because it might be several years, Lord willing, if He allows us to continue as a local church. We should never even take that for granted. Should the Lord be pleased to continue to gather us together, we're in this study for the long haul. The reason is, I think we can all do with a little better understanding of God. I know that we can all do with a little better understanding of what He has to say about Himself and about us in His Word. And really, even to say that we're going to do this for several years might be an understatement, because the undertaking of systematic theology, any study of God, any study of those things relative to God, should really be a study that lasts a lifetime. And so I'm not going to take the rest of your lives to do this, but and we're certainly not going to hit every major point that you might like to hit. We're not going to talk about everything that you might think we're going to talk about. You've got to have limits as you go through this. But we are going to take a very slow, deliberate approach to understanding God and who He says He is in His Word and who He says we are in order to better serve Him and to better understand Him. Well, last Lord's Day, we began with a study of theology proper, and I pointed out at that time that theology is simply a compound word made up of two words, theos and logos, which means the word about God, or the expression of God, or the study of God. And again, I'm not going to go over everything that we talked about last week, but I would like to kind of rehearse in your minds what we discovered about theology proper, which is the study of God the Father. Remember, we talked about the different branches of systematic theology that we're going to be looking at in this study. The first is theology proper, that's God the Father. Then we're going to talk about Christology, which is the study of Christ. Then we're going to talk about pneumatology, which is the study of the Holy Spirit. And then you've got soteriology, and you've got a little bit of anthropology in there, and you've got ecclesiology and eschatology, and on and on it goes. We're going to cover a lot of those things as we go through this study. But we started with theology proper. And I began that study by first pointing out that in spite of what the so-called atheist maintains, even he knows that God exists. In other words, there's no such thing as a true atheist. There can't be. Well, how do we know? Because God says there can't be. And I know that to the atheist, that's circular reasoning. Okay, you're telling me that a God I don't believe in says that I don't exist. You see how that works? I mean, that's why presuppositional apologetics is superior to all other forms of apologetics, because we realize until the atheist, so-called, understands that God does exist and that His Word is true and inerrant and infallible and all the rest, then we'll never really agree on the matter at all. He'll continue in his denial that God exists. We'll continue believing that He doesn't exist because God says He doesn't exist. Now, where does God say that? Well, He says that in Romans 1, 18 through 21. I would invite you to turn there. We're just going to read this and kind of leave it as it stands. It's not a very difficult passage to understand. Paul writes, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened." Now again, someone who's suppressing the truth of God in unrighteousness will not even believe this statement. Why? Because they're suppressing that truth. They don't want to believe that statement. And we've talked before about one of the primary reasons the so-called atheist refuses to believe in God is because if there is a God, he instinctively knows that he's accountable to that God. And he does not want to be accountable to anyone except himself. And he knows that if he's accountable to this God that he says doesn't exist, he's going to have to live according to the standards that this God has stipulated. And if he doesn't live according to those standards, he will be judged accordingly. The atheists, that's just too much. They want to live their own lives. They want to be these free spirits. They want to be divorced from any concept of God because those concepts of God, all of them, in some way or another, hold him accountable for either believing or not believing. And again, the atheist is not going to listen to your biblical counsel because he doesn't even accept it as such. Now, last week we asked the question, is there a way that we can appeal not to the spirit of the so-called atheist? Only God can do that. But is there a way that we can appeal to the intellect of the atheist and at least put him on more shaky ground? At least help him understand that his own arguments are untenable in light of just what he's able to observe. Now again, we're not talking about leading to salvation. That's a completely different subject. All I'm talking about is I'm seeking to answer the question, is there enough ammunition, so to speak, that we can use against the atheist and convince him that he's on shaky ground, that he might want to reconsider his atheism? I think there is. And we talked about a couple of the arguments that we might use to at least appeal to the intellect of the atheist. And by the way, this is true of any unbeliever. This is true of any non-deist. Remember, there's a difference between the atheist and the non-deist. The non-deist would be closer to someone like the agnostic. And we're going to talk about the agnostic a little bit more in just a minute, so I don't want to give that away. But there are ways that we can appeal to those who don't believe to show them the folly of their own reasoning, to show them the holes in their own logic, so to speak. And we continue our study this morning. We talked about two arguments, I said. First was the what? Cosmological argument. And the cosmological argument just looks at the whole of creation and determines that with its intricacy and its precision, all the things that have been created point to a creator. In other words, it can't be a coincidence that we see such precision, that we see such intricacy. Scientists have even developed, even secular scientists, have developed a concept called irreducible complexity. In other words, no matter how far down the rabbit hole you go, so to speak, everything becomes infinitely more complex, not less complex. And I could go on and on talking about the protozoans and the euglenas that, you know, there's a euglena, which is a single-cell organism that actually has a little tail on it that propels it throughout your system, right? And that little tail, they've learned, has a motor in it that causes it to spin. And people are like, oh, it's not a motor. I mean, come on now. No, it's a motor. It's got a rotor. It's got magnetically charged or chemically charged stators that go around the little rotor. And chemical reactions cause that thing to move. And it propels itself wherever. Now, you look at it under a microscope. Where's it going? It doesn't know. God knows. Where's it going? It's going right where it needs to go. You ever wonder how the intricacies of your body actually work? I've told you before this. Just consider a single cell in your body. And your mind will be blown the more you learn about it. And guess what? This is another example of irreducible complexity because scientists have never even plumbed the depths of a single cell, much less the constituent parts that make up the cell. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. And that is evidence, that level of detail, that level of intricacy is evidence of a creator. That's the cosmological argument. The next argument we discussed was the teleological argument. It comes from the word telos, telos meaning end. So that simply tells us that what has been created appears to have been created with an end in mind. In other words, things function. They function for a purpose. And blind chance can never create things or never cause things to come to be, especially so many things that have a purpose. And not only that, not only do they have a purpose, they have what we call a symbiotic purpose. They have a purpose where they work together to do whatever the end is for which they were created. Right? And so again, that's the teleological argument. Every man can see that there's an end in mind to everything that's been created. Well, this morning we're going to move on and talk about a third argument. And it's actually two arguments combined into one. We call this the anthropological / moral argument. The anthropological / moral argument. Now, again, don't let the big word scare you or intimidate you. The word anthropological, you know what an anthropologist is, right? An anthropologist is someone who studies the development of man. Anthropos is the Greek word for man. And so when we talk about anthropological arguments for the existence of God, we're talking about arguments that can be based on the observance of mankind in general. Okay? Why is that important? Well, that's important because the atheist, and I would lump every kind of unbeliever in this category, really, the atheist sees man as a purely biological being. Purely biological. In other words, he's just a machine put together, made up of randomly generated parts that just happen to work together very intricately, that all came together by chance. And not only that, they repeated themselves so far about 7 billion times on this earth. But it's all by chance. Random chance. We can tell on the surface that makes no sense at all. And we'll talk about that in more in detail in just a minute. But talk about how dark the atheist's mind really is. To believe that all of this came about by way of random chance, the odds against that are not only astronomical, they're beyond astronomical. We use the term unbelievable quite a bit. No, this is really unbelievable, not to be believed. And we base that on this anthropological / moral argument. The moral argument, the anthropological argument for the existence of God, suggests first and foremost that man has been created as the imago Dei. In other words, he's been created in the image of God. Now, where do we get that idea? Well, we get that from Genesis 1, 26 through 28. Genesis 1, 26 through 28, we read there, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our own image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.' God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." Uh-oh, that's not popular today. "God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth.'" Now, not only do the Scriptures tell us that we were made in the image of God, the Scriptures also tell us how we were made in the image of God. Were we made, for example, physically in the image of God? No. No, because God Himself is incorporeal. God is spirit. And there are people who would say, well, the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ, He's not spirit. He has a human body. He didn't have until the Incarnation. Prior to the Incarnation, he was the only personage within the triune Godhead that was able to physically manifest himself. We see this as the angel of the Lord. We see this as the pillar of fire which guided the Israelites by night, or guarded them by night, and the pillar of cloud that guided them by day. We also see this in all the what we would call theophanies and Christophanies, the pre-incarnate appearances of Christ. He was the rock that was struck. He was the bronze serpent raised on the pole, and so on and so forth. But only when he was incarnated, when he became flesh and dwelled among us, as John says, did he take on a human body. So we can't even argue that we were made in the image of Christ in his body. We were not made physically in the image of God. So in what way were we made in the image of God? We were made in the image of God in that we've been given intellect, emotions, a will. We have this sense of his communicable attributes. We're going to talk about those probably starting next week. God has what we call communicable attributes and incommunicable attributes. The communicable attributes are those things that God is able to share with us as image bearers of God. And we'll talk again more about those next week, but among those would be our ability to love, our sense of mercy, our sense of righteousness, our sense of justice. We understand those things innately because we've been made in the image of God. And again, you know, when you need to remember that when God formed Adam from the dust of the ground, we're told that he breathed into Adam the breath of life. And Adam at that point became a living nephesh, a living soul. Now, this is not just God breathing like CPR. You know, he's not just breathing life into Adam. He's also imbuing Adam with a spiritual life. He's giving him his spirit, the spiritual component that will link him with God as an image bearer of God. We are spiritual beings. One of the most difficult questions for atheists to answer along these lines, and this is where the moral part of the argument comes in, the atheist is hard-pressed to answer the question, where does morality come from? Where does common morality come from? And there are people who would try to argue, well, morality is not common. It most certainly is. One of the most eye-opening discussions I ever had with any human being on planet Earth was back probably 20 years ago now at a Shepherd's Conference in California. I had the opportunity of meeting Steve Saint, who is the son of Nate Saint. Nate Saint, you'll recall, was with Jim Elliott, Roger Udarian, and what was the other guy's name? A couple of other guys. There were five missionaries to the Waldani Indians in the jungles of Ecuador, and they were killed. Their bodies sent down the river. Nate Saint was one of those, and his son Steve joined the ministry there, and eventually they led these Waldani natives to Christ. And one of them, the very man that killed Jim Elliott and the others, his name was Ming Kai, he actually showed up at the Shepherd's Conference, and Dan and I were able to talk to them on a break, one-on-one. I mean, if you're ever in a situation like that, you know, you think ordering your food at Sonic's hard. Yes, I'm one of those people. Anybody here ever freeze up when they say, can I take your order, please? Okay. I'm the only one? Anyway, it was one of those moments. There's this Ming Kai guy standing there, little guy about this tall. Looks like he couldn't hurt a fly. Steve Saint's own kids called him grandfather. I mean, the guy's a little guy. And I'm thinking, what should I ask this guy? What do you ask the guy who killed Jim Elliott and now knows Christ? You know? But it occurred to me to ask him about this thing called morality. And I asked him through Steve, of course. He didn't speak any English. But I said, Steve, I want you to ask him, if prior to Jim Elliott and company coming to give the gospel to them, I want you to ask him, they were headhunters. Cannibalistic. And I want you to ask him, did they ever get the sense that what they were doing when they were killing neighboring tribes, when they were killing each other, what we would call for sport, I want you to ask him, did they know that it was wrong? And when he asked Ming Kai the question, his eyes lit up. And he said, yes, we always knew that it was wrong. but we could never explain why we knew that. Folks, this is an unreached tribe in the jungles of Ecuador who dates back to prehistoric times and up until the time those missionaries showed up, still lived in prehistoric times. And they understood that murder was wrong. They couldn't tell you why. They just understood that murder was wrong. But again, we haven't answered the question. Where does that sense of morality come from? And I've done some subsequent study over the years about tribes in these remotest parts of the world. And almost without fail, well, from my studies, without fail, every one of them has a certain moral code. And included in that code is a prohibition against murder. Many believe that we learn to stop killing one another because we grew or we evolved to understand that continuing the practice would be a hindrance to ensuring the longevity of the human race. You've heard that before, probably from evolutionary textbooks where they'll say, yeah, you know, people learn that they just should stop killing each other because it wasn't doing them any favors in terms of workforce, in terms of populating the planet, as they also knew that they were supposed to be doing. What's implausible about this is that in actuality, man continued killing his fellow man, but began insisting that their god or gods demanded those killings. I mean, think about the human sacrifices of the Mayans, the Incans, the Vikings, who had a whole plethora of gods that they were trying, you know, number one being Odin, that they tried to appease. We think about the quintessential old Hollywood movie where, you know, there's a big volcano and somebody's got to be thrown into the volcano to appease the god Pele. Where do these notions come from? What they did was they continued their killing, but they started to attribute their killing to the will of someone greater than themselves. Where does that idea come from? And why did they develop these religious reasons for killing? They did so because they knew it was wrong. And the only way they could placate their own consciences was to do it in the name of some deity. That's very interesting. It's fascinating. And this is something you'll find universally. This is something you see the world over. These are not isolated incidents. In every case where man kills man, he acknowledges there's a moral code that prevents him from actually doing that. Yeah.
Jay. Now in Islam, the radical growing up in Islam.
Oh, let's not bug the Muslims this morning. We see it in our own culture. Millions upon millions of the unborn are slaughtered because it's legal. Right? We kill our unborn because, number one, it's legal, and there are places that do that. And the cops aren't lined up out front to arrest those murderers. So we've placated our own collective conscience. We can continue to murder children as long as it's legal. What kind of twisted world are we living in? Same twisted world as everybody lives in. We all have this innate sense that what we're doing is wrong. Even these radicals out there today who are doing everything they can to overturn the moral fabric of our society, they know what they're doing is wrong. They know instinctively. They're just having too much fun doing it and don't want to stop. We know that we're moral creatures. As believers, we know that because we're made in the image of God and we're born with a sense of right and wrong. And if you don't believe that we're born with a sense of right and wrong, just watch the youngest child who's never been taught about a certain behavior and watch how they react. You ever see a little kid that's just started walking? I've observed this phenomenon in my own family. We never at any time told our kids that things on the coffee table were not to be touched. I mean, there was a time we did, once they started doing that. But guess what? They started doing that before they were ever instructed that it was wrong. And what did they do every time? They do what any child does. And then you're like, no. Right? But what they're doing instinctively. How do they know? They know. They know because they're fellow image bearers of God, and they've been instilled with this sense of morality, even at that young age. Now, do they fully understand the ramifications of that? No. Do they fully understand their nature as sinners? No. Do they fully understand the penalty for sin? No. I'm not going there this morning. What I'm saying is they all have this built-in faculty as image bearers of God that tells them when they're doing right and when they're doing wrong. We actually have a scriptural precedent for this. Look at Romans chapter 2. I believe it's chapter 2. I think maybe I have a typo. Maybe not. Romans 2, verse 14. Romans 2, verse 14. Listen to what Paul says. Paul argues here that when the Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these, not having the law, are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. That's what Paul's talking about. In other words, you don't need to be given this knowledge about certain things. You have this knowledge. And it will either accuse you or defend you. What Paul's expressing here is that men everywhere have a common sense of morality. We just do. We just do. So that's the anthropological moral argument for the existence of God. We know God exists because, unlike the rest of creation, man bears certain attributes or characteristics that can only be explained with the realization that God created us as unique image bearers of Himself. The animal kingdom does not live according to this moral code. I mean, if you believe that, you've not watched nearly enough of the Discovery Channel, right? Because, I mean, you go on a safari, and I mean, some of those things are just, they just blow your mind, right? I mean, I saw an eagle on a video. I forget who it was sent me this video this last week, but this big eagle taking down a full-size deer. Here's this eagle in flight chasing this deer down. The deer doesn't stand a chance, even though he can run like 60 miles an hour. This eagle can fly far faster. And he grabs that deer by the back haunches and just, it's over. It took about 10 minutes, but I didn't watch the whole thing, no. But, I mean, it's amazing how we can see demonstrations. The animal kingdom has little regard for that. You throw a chicken in the same pen as a fox or a coyote, it's game on, and the chicken will lose. Do you think the coyote feels any remorse for what he's done? You think the fox walks around with his head hung low, thinking, I probably shouldn't have done that? No, because they're not image bearers of God. The animal kingdom behaves in a much different way. That in and of itself is a proof that we are image bearers of God. There's no other part of the animal kingdom that's developed this moral code. And people look at dogs and little babies in the animal kingdom, and they say, oh, it's so sweet how mom takes care of the little baby, and doesn't she love him? They don't know anything about that. I hate to break it to you, but your dog, when you get home, he's standing there wagging his tail, and he's just prancing and jumping up on you, and you think, oh, he loves me so much. He doesn't love you. He can't love you. I know a lot of people just went, a lot of people are like, that's the last time I'm coming to this church. I'm a dog lover. I love my dog whether he reciprocates it or not. But what you're seeing there is animal instinct. What you're seeing there is some sort of desire for a quid pro quo arrangement between the two of you. I'm going to sit here and wag my tail and look cute and pant because when I do, you do things for me that are pleasing. You give me food, you give me a pat on the head, you let me sleep in the bed with you, whatever that case might be. He is totally and utterly self-centered.
That's right.
Self-absorbed. Now you might interpret that any way you want.
Right.
You know? And that's like when pets die, and we hate it when pets die. And we say they crossed that rainbow bridge. There ain't no rainbow bridge, folks. Truth is truth, and truth is hard sometimes. But if we're going to understand how unique we are among creation, we need to start understanding how ununique the rest of the animal kingdom is and how blessed we are to be image bearers of the Most High God. Uniquely blessed. You see how we can dumb that down when we bring every other part of the animal kingdom in? Well, they have souls. No, they don't. Animals don't have souls. See, if they do cross that rainbow bridge, where are they going? Sorry, parents. You can explain that to your children. I know. I'm going to get the hate mail now. Well, finally, there's the ontological argument. Ontological argument. Now, the ontological argument's a little more abstract than the other arguments. We think about the cosmological argument, the teleological argument, the anthropological moral argument. Those are easy kind of to understand, easily explained at least. This argument's a little more abstract, but it's just as easy to understand. The ontological argument suggests that the very fact that the concept of God is universal is proof that He exists. And that makes a lot of sense. How did man, every man, all over the place, develop this common idea, not in the one true God, but develop this notion that there is a God who is more powerful than they are, to whom they owe obedience and fealty? Where did that concept come from? We would say that's just another proof, the ontological proof, for the existence of God. The fact that man can conceive of God is a pretty telling proof that God must exist. Now the question is, it's the same as the anthropological moral argument, where does this common belief come from? Comes from our being made in the image of God. So, this leads to something else really that I want to bring to your attention before we begin studying the attributes of God next Lord's Day, Lord willing. And when I say attributes, I prefer what the Puritans would say. They would use the word perfections as opposed to attributes, because attributes are things that we attribute to God. God is not who He is because we have made Him so. God is not who He is because we attribute certain things to Him. He is who He is because these things are demonstrations of His perfections. And again, we'll talk about those things next week. I'm probably going to continue calling them attributes because that's just the way we've grown accustomed to referring to those things. But before we do that, I want to talk about some of the sinful ways that man demonstrates that his understanding of God's been twisted and distorted over time. Although every man is without excuse when it comes to acknowledging the existence of God, and although there are people who claim to be atheists who are sometimes militant in their insistence that God doesn't exist, which I've never been able to figure out. That's the height of lunacy when someone argue so vehemently against something they say doesn't exist. Doesn't make sense on the surface, right? But one of the questions we need to ask about that is, how did they get there? In what sinful ways does man demonstrate that his understanding of God has been twisted? That sin has darkened his understanding of God. In the garden, Adam and Eve knew God. They knew God. And they worshiped God. They walked in the cool of the day with God in the garden. But when sin entered the picture, when Adam and Eve fell, that knowledge of God became twisted. That knowledge of God became irreparably tainted outside the finished work of Christ, who was able to reconcile us once again to this God and help us to know Him. But even with this reconciliation that we've experienced, we don't know God the way Adam and Eve knew God. We've not seen the full restoration. We will one day, because we'll see Him as He is. We will see Him face to face. But right now we don't. What are some of the ways that these things have become twisted? We're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but we do need to have some familiarity with these categories. The first category we want to talk about is the agnostic. What's the difference between an atheist and an agnostic?
Honesty.
Yeah, there you go. The agnostic's honest. You know, the word agnostic comes from, it's not a compound word, but it's the word gnosis, which means knowledge, that's modified by the negative prefix a. Anytime you see a, it's something that negates whatever word it prefixes. So agnostic or agnostic means someone without knowledge. The agnostic is the honest person who says, you know, I'm not going to say whether there is a God or whether there isn't a God. I just don't know. I don't know. The agnostic is not generally hostile to the ideal of God. He simply maintains that we can't know for certain whether God exists. Usually the agnostic bases his brand of unbelief on the fact that the existence of God can't be scientifically proven, so it's not even worthy of discussion or consideration. Right? So at least he's honest. I just don't know. And I'll accept that answer from the person who's still dead in sin. He doesn't know because he can't know. Right? He can at least know the existence of God, but even so, he's still he's very close to the atheist, but not willing to go that far. Like Jesse said, he's at least honest about it. Well, next we have the evolutionist. And you know all about the evolutionist. The evolutionist is one who begins with the premise that there is no God and then seeks to explain all of life apart from any involvement by God. And just as an aside here, I believe evolutionary teaching is responsible for a great deal of the evil we see in society today. You know, any view of man, any view of creation itself that's divorced from God's involvement in the process is evil. It's evil. It goes beyond merely saying there is no God by insisting that everything you see in the entire universe was created and came to be and evolved by chance. Blind chance. And that's evil. A purely scientific, non-supernatural approach to life will always lead man to view his fellow man, as I mentioned a moment ago, to include the unborn as a simple biological entity, a collection of cells. You've even heard that in the media when people talk about people who are pro-abortion. They talk about, well, it's not really a baby until, you know, it's able to breathe on its own and take care of itself. It's not really a baby, it's just a collection of cells. It's just a lump of protoplasm. And that's evil enough in and of itself, but guess what? They generally think the same way about you and me. And the older you get, the more worthless you get. And so, you know, if you look at all of life, if you look at mankind as just this collection of biological entities, these machines that wear out with time, and then just like your tools in the garage, when they wear out, you just throw them out. That's the same way you're going to treat human beings. That's the reason human beings are treated. That's why we have things called euthanasia. You know? You're too expensive to take care of. Let's just get it over with. This is why we have nursing homes filled to the brim with people who are ignored, marginalized, people who often die alone because their usefulness has run out. After all, they're just biological entities. People with Alzheimer's, people with dementia, you know, they need to be put to death, according to some people, because, you know, they've just lost their ability to function in a way that benefits society. And once you've lost your ability to function in a way that benefits society, the world will be better off without you. One less mouth to feed, right? It's tragic. And it all stems from evolutionary thought. All of it. And let me just add this. Evolutionary thought has given rise to advances in technology. Advances that are intended to replace human beings. Now, I'm getting a little deeper into this probably than I should, but think about that for just a minute. And you say, yeah, I can think about that, because now we got self-checkout at the grocery store. You know what self-checkout has done? It's gotten rid of jobs that people need to feed their own families. There's no compassion in an electronic checker, right? They tell you it's lowered the prices, but it hasn't. Those things are far more expensive to maintain than any human working. But what has it also removed? It's removed interaction. I go to Arlen's, New Braunfels, a lot of times for my groceries, because I like interacting with the little old lady who works there, who asks me every time how my life's going. Who will stand, and if there's nobody else in line, will talk to me like I'm her grandson. That's what we're missing. Think about that thing you carry around in your purse or in your pocket, that cell phone. You realize that single advance in technology is responsible for ruining relationships, for rendering our children unable to communicate face to face. Wow, that's a leap going from evolution to technology. No, it's not. Again, I'm not going to get into the details, but it's all the same thing. This evolutionary thought. We need to cater to each other. We need to cater to each other in the most efficient, most impersonal way we can to get things done. We need to stop that. As image bearers of God, we need to be treating each other as image bearers of God. And valuing life. Valuing human interaction. Valuing relationships. Do you realize, I read an article the other day that says, travel, for example, to see grandparents has been cut by more than half with the advent of FaceTime and Skype. Why spend all that money to go see grandma and grandpa? We can just pull them up on the TV and talk to them. See what I'm talking about? So that's the evolutionary view. That's one way that this understanding of who God is has been twisted and all but lost. Well, there's a third category. That's the polytheist. The polytheist has twisted this knowledge of God into a belief that there are many gods. Polytheism is just another way of silencing the voice of the one true God and really taking a pluralistic approach to God himself by insisting, no, there are all kinds of gods. The polytheists, among the polytheists that are most active today are the Hindus. They hate that label. Don't ever tell a Hindu person that he's polytheistic. He'll deny it. And yet, he'll spend all day and all night telling you about the thousands of gods and goddesses that fill their pantheon of deity. I don't know what else to call you but a polytheist. Right? Then there's the pantheists. What's a pantheist? Yeah. Not that God is in everything. We're not talking about the omnipresence of God. We're talking about the fact that the pantheist believes that God is everything. God is that chair you're sitting in. God is that tree out there. God is the rock. God is the grass. God is the sky. one of the most prominent pantheists of recent memory was John Denver. Anybody remember John Denver? Take Me Home, Country Roads, Rocky Mountain High, all of his songs about nature and the eagles and the mountains and the trees. He was a pantheist, a self-avowed pantheist. He talked about those things because he believed those things were God. We see a lot of pantheism in a lot of the unreached tribes, you know, where they won't touch a certain rock because that's God, or they won't cut down a certain tree. That's God. The Buddhist is a pantheist of sorts. The Buddhist believes in doing no harm to anything. Why? Because there's deity there. And it might be your old Aunt Gladys who's come back as a cricket. You know, that's problematic if you step on her. They believe, no, it's true. If you step on her and that's her, that reduces her chance of coming back in a higher life form. It's all a type of pantheistic thought. And then finally we have the deists. What does deism teach? You know who one of the greatest deists of our day, not our day, but in this country was? Thomas Jefferson. He was a deist. Now what do deists think? Deists believe in a completely impersonal God. Deists believe that God created everything, but He doesn't sustain it. That's why you see entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, where everything goes from order to chaos. That's why everything's winding down. The deist believes that God wound the clock up and it's eventually going to just wind down and stop. God's not a personal God. It was this thought of deism that led Friedrich Nietzsche in the 60s to declare on the cover of Time magazine, God is dead. And again, this is just another example of how the knowledge of God has been twisted and reduced to placate the minds of those who refuse to believe in unrighteousness. And all of these things can be tied back to one thing, and that's sin. All of these things have their genesis in Genesis. When Adam and Eve fell, they died spiritually. That connection with God that would have helped them understand certain things about Him, that knowledge that they had of Him, was horribly disfigured. And we see the results even today. Well, if you're with us for the first time this morning, please, I mean, a lot of people are like, if you're with us for the first time, you're probably thinking, oh, I didn't know I was coming to a seminary class this morning. Thought I was coming to hear the Word of God. Well, you're going to hear the Word of God in the next hour. These are just the preliminary steps that we need to take, laying the groundwork for the discussion of God's attributes. When we start talking about the perfections of God, this is where things get really, really interesting and beneficial to the child of God. But you can't get there until you lay the groundwork and at least understand a little bit better why man is the way he is, especially the person trapped in unbelief. We're going to talk about those perfections again in our study.